at this point, I'm going to do my best to get a song playing. Let's see if we can do that.
Okay, then let's save some more stuff.
And the doctor said, son, you look older than me, and I'm 71. You're falling apart, you're not living right. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said loud, you got to stop hanging out with that old in crowd. Living's a battle, and you're losing the fight. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, boy, your body is a temple. It's not a toy.
All right, now... Now you're listening to Ken Logan, Dr. Ken Logan, and the Doctor's Inn is the name of this show. It's at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock the third Thursday, and that's 6 in the evening, as you know, if you're listening. So the third Thursday of every month, I cover subjects of health interest and medical interest. And I was thinking about a drive-in over here today. You know, as a doctor, as a physician in this country, and for my life, 30-some-odd years as a physician, the thing that seems the most important to me is teaching. And I'm not unusual in that way as a physician. How I learned it was that physicians, in reality, the biggest thing we do, the most important thing and the largest, greatest thing we do time-wise, effort-wise, energy-wise with people that we help is teaching. And it's like that in other healthcare professions as well. Teaching is foremost. And so that's what this show is about. And I try to cover subjects on this show that I think are of interest that you might not hear so much about otherwise. And that's going to happen today. In a minute, I'm going to tell you about today's show. But just a sneak preview, I've got a live guest in the studio. I didn't have to use duct tape or chains or anything. He's willingly sitting in the chair and ready to educate us. So, and I'm going to tell you who that is in just a minute. First of all, however, the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And now I said the word underwriters, didn't I? So now I'm going to talk more about underwriters. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by you, the listener. When you give to this station, help it stay on the air, monetary gifts that you do. And also to our generous underwriters, such as Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing also a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter, newsletters. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsoftheart.net. And by Drunken Dumpling in Chico, serving locally sourced, fresh, handmade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120. That's 120. Just behind Nobby's. Open 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. On Tuesdays through Thursdays, and from 11 a.m. to 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday through Friday and Saturday. I'm going to tell you that again. Open 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday, and from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Details on Facebook, Instagram, and at drunkendumplingchico.com. drunkendumpling.com. Drunken Dumpling, where they love food, flavor, and our community. And today's show is you were sitting on the edge of your chair waiting to know who my guest is, and I'm going to tell you in just a second. Today's show, you're going to hear information that you've never heard before, subjects, common sense explanations of some subjects relating to healthcare availability. The bottom line will be the way healthcare availability sorts out across the world, and then compared that to the United States and why. You're going to hear the details of why that is relative to how the structures are such and the governments are such in the other countries where that, including industrialized countries, where that is occurring. And you're going to hear about it by somebody who knows what he's talking about, somebody who's learned in this subject. And the subject is actually democratic socialism. And you're going to hear a lot about that and definitions thereof. Tom Reed is my guest. And Tom, can you say hello into your mic and let me see if we can hear you?
I certainly can. Hello.
Do that again, please.
Hello.
Great.
Is that good?
It's pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm going to want you to right on the mic. As you know, Tom has been on the show before. Thank goodness. This man knows so much. Thanks a lot. Tom Reed is a longtime Chico activist and the founder of what locally is named Butte County Health Care Coalition. It's been around for how many years, Tom?
Since 1991. That would make it almost 32 years.
31 to 32 years. I didn't know it was that long. My gosh. You too may be a member, can be a member if you'd like to support. Or may already be a member. If you'd like to support a universal health approach, healthcare approach in this country. In other words, everybody having equal and appropriate healthcare. Tom will talk to us about how you could become a member of Butte County Healthcare Coalition in a minute. He's also a member of a national organization that I also am a member of, PNHP, which is Physicians for National Health Program. Now, Tom is not a physician, nor does he play one on television, does he?
Only rarely.
Only rarely does he play physician on television. But I want everyone listening to know that national organization called Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP, anyone can be a member, be you a lay person, be you a physician, be you other healthcare professional. Physician for National Health Program, PNHP, you can also be a member. And then Tom Reed, my guest, is also a chapter member.
Charter.
A charter. Oh.
Charter.
Oh, gosh. So even bigger than I thought. I would say chapter member. He's a I wrote that down incorrectly. He's a charter member, my gosh. Of the Democratic Socialists of America organization. So this is a big deal. Our very own Tom Reed. Democratic socialism. When you hear that term, listeners, you may or may not know what that means. But you're going to find out right now. And Tom Reed... Hello.
You are so full of it.
No, I'm not. I tell the truth and nothing but the truth. I've got my right hand up. And listen, Tom, thank you so much for being on the show today and educating us. And
thanks for having me, Ken.
Certainly. And remember, listeners, democratic socialism, the reason we're educating you and me about this is has to do with the bottom line, among other things, many things. But part of which is healthcare availability for all of us equally, and some other things equally. So you'll, Tom,
yes,
talk to us, teach us.
Okay. Good Lord. Okay. The reason that I'm doing this, and I've been trying to do similar things, really is not actually frivolous. It's that we're having a very serious debates in this country today, but the debate is limited and kind of truncated because whenever you get too progressive, let alone actually declare yourself to be a socialist, as I certainly am.
Declare yourself a what?
To be a socialite.
A socialist. And you hear that, that may ring in your ears, people, listeners, but you're going to, I beg you to listen what that word means and why it has a bit of a stigma, it's embarrassing why it would have a stigma in this country. Okay, Tom.
It has a stigma because the people who own the country, the American ruling class, financiers and so forth, they don't like it because those of us who are socialists or are close really want to have a society where they don't have nearly as much wealth and power, where they don't have in fact any more wealth and power than any of the rest of us. And they just happen to own the media. They happen to have tremendous influence in the churches, in education, those kind of things. So they have a pretty easy time spreading their word. And to the extent that we take their views seriously, we have a very hard time developing serious, workable alternatives to the difficulties that face our country. The concentration of wealth, lack of access to health care, looming, if not actual environmental catastrophes and so forth. So they don't like socialism because to the extent that socialists are successful, to the extent that average working people, middle people, class people in this country become empowered, they lose their grotesque influence and they will undoubtedly have to forfeit some of their extraordinary wealth.
So wealth and power in the hands of a limited few of the wealthy in a country or capitalism and is the basis of capitalism. And I'm looking at an outline or a kind of an essay that Tom wrote for today's show, and I'm going to pick pieces off of it.
Pick away. Said.
You know, and you started out by saying if we, the people in this country, all of us, were satisfied with our current socioeconomic system that we have here in our country, in other words, the bulk of fighting to make ends meet check to check and getting less and less wealth well off as time goes on, but the wealthy getting wealthier. And we're going to talk about that, just the very definition of the word capitalism means never enough and never satisfied.
Right.
So it's our demise, the people's demise, and it's not sustainable. And that's true. You point that out. So if we were all satisfied with our current socioeconomic system, then we wouldn't need to talk about an alternative such as democratic socialism. Many of us, are not satisfied. Those of us who aren't on top of the heap are not satisfied with our system.
Yeah, if we were all satisfied, I would be home having a beer.
Right. Capitalism is not, like you say, capitalism is not only, and we have capitalism, a system of capitalism as opposed to socialism. And we don't have a significant combination of either, of the both of them, which some countries do. But capitalism is not only an economic system, it generates a socio-cultural system consistent with how it's functioning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, people are socialized in this country to believe that capitalism is a natural state of affairs, and that the kind of people that are generated within a capitalist system, the kind of personalities, the kind of behavioral patterns, are natural. That's just the way things are. But that's not true.
Like common sense, that's just the way it is. Why wouldn't we think that? Yeah.
I think I mentioned in my little notes there an Italian Marxist philosopher named Antonio Gramsci, who spent a whole lot of time in Mussolini's prisons. And Gramsci pointed out that one of the greatest sources of power of any ruling class is the ability to define what's common sense. So yeah. that people simply say, we don't need to talk about socialism. Everybody knows it doesn't work. Everybody knows it. Well, it's not true.
It's just not true. But that's what we've been taught to think. And what you just said, say that again. You said the system that is in power, the capitalistic, powerful, moneyed of those country.
The greatest power they have is the ability to define what's common sense, what everybody knows to be true, even if it's not. We get letters to the editor in the Enterprise Record periodically denouncing socialism by people who clearly have no idea what on earth they're talking about.
Yep.
But they know they hate it.
But yeah, they know they hate it.
Even though they may not know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Like I was saying at the beginning of the show, where there's just the word socialism, it means bad things like communism. Communism means bad things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up hearing that.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was a senior in high school that I had a teacher, a wonderful teacher named George Lester, who actually said that it's possible to have democratic socialism. And everybody kind of dropped our jaws because we never heard that before, because we always thought that socialism was communism was Stalinism, blah, 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 none of which is true. Martin Luther King Jr. was a socialist, a democratic socialist. He wasn't too public about that, but he certainly made it clear in his writings and private conversations.
So Martin,
he is not Joseph Stalin.
Right.
King and Joseph Stalin are not the same people.
In no way, shape, or form was he like that at all. So Martin Luther King Jr. was actually a democratic socialist at heart, as was
Albert Einstein,
Helen Keller,
and
of course
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders,
I think
of course.
Mentioned in there that what was the guy's name? Francis Bellamy, the guy who in fact wrote the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh yeah,
was a Christian socialist.
Yeah, how about that? So say that again. You know, all people who want to just cringe at the word socialism and think how un-American, think about that. Francis Bellamy, who composed our very Pledge of Allegiance that you learn when you're a kid and put your hand on your heart and speak it, was a Christian socialist. Do you hear me say that?
I heard
Listen
you say
to
that.
Albert Einstein was, because he was a man with a brain.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King Jr. also.
And Helen Keller, and we could go on.
We could go on and on, huh? Yeah. And you know, just saying that Martin Luther King Jr., a socialist, because he cared. The words out of my mouth were going to be quickly, yes, because he cared about other people much and equally to himself. And that is one thing that I notice about socialism in the countries that maybe we're going to talk about, and what parts of their government and the way their government functions are socialistic, means caring for their fellow citizens, as opposed to capitalism, which is all single greed oriented instead.
And our capitalist culture leads us to believe that that's normal, that we should be that way.
That's how we've been taught.
That I really shouldn't give a darn about your well-being unless you're my personal friend or whatnot.
Yeah.
Another thing
like President Trump, ex-President Trump.
Yeah. Another thing right along that same line is that you have people all the time saying, well, American people simply won't stand for socialism. They don't like socialism. They want socialism to go away.
Okay, now hear what Tom Reed is saying. So we get fed this line that the people of our country don't like socialism. No, we don't like socialism at all. Now tell us what you're going to – I know what you're going to tell us. Go ahead.
What I'm going to tell you is that the polls systematically over at least the last couple of decades, what I've been keeping track, show that like anywhere from 30 to 40% of American people say they like socialism. They think it sounds like a good idea.
So the polls that have been done over the last several years ask about socialism in our country, the polls, 30-40% – people are in favor of socialism. In other words, they feel positive about it. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, Tom, here's what I thought. And that's in people who probably don't, Americans, some of the Americans that took that poll, that were members, gave their opinion in that poll, probably didn't actually even understand the full breadth of what the definition of socialism is, even.
Undoubtedly, but I do know that they have been subjected, like all of us have, to lies and propaganda by pro-capitalist, anti-egalitarian forces from Wall Street on down.
Oh, yeah, and Wall Street being right on the top of it.
And the Democratic Socialists of America, of which I am proud to be a charter member, 1982.
Wow.
DSA was formed by the merger of two pre-existing organizations, and I could go into that, but I won't. But we came into existence as this organization in 1982.
Yeah, I have a thing on the history of socialism in the United States. Gosh, it's a thick.
You're going to know more than you ever wanted to know about this topic.
You know, it's been a battle. Socialism, I've noticed in this country, has been a battle for the last 150 years.
Yeah.
Every time I was reading about there would be rise and fall of it anyway, what came to my mind was they just get pummeled by the people of power, in the media, who is owned by the people of power. Yeah. They don't want the words about socialism to be in their paper.
Michael Parente is a Marxist historian. I heard an interview with him one time, and he talked about being on, I think it was Washington Week in Review, because they wanted to have all sides shown, so they had him on this panel with five anti-socialists, and so he said that he'd have a question, and before he could answer it, four other guys were jumping down his throats. He said, "You know, I could have answered any of the questions, but I couldn't answer five questions all at once." So that's kind of like Noam Chomsky says that he refuses to do TV interviews because he says there's nothing that you can say in 15 seconds where you can be made to look like an idiot by somebody who has 45 minutes. But anyway, moving on. Where were we? Oh God.
I don't know.
How
about distribution of the concentration of wealth?
Okay,
country and in other countries.
Yeah, I think I listed on there four key areas with which I think democratic socialists are particularly concerned. One is the concentration of wealth and power. I know probably everybody listening to us is well aware that this country has gone since about the mid 70s. Has undergone a tremendous concentration of wealth, enormous increases in productivity, and almost all the increase in value has gone to the top couple percent. And the higher you go up that scale, the more concentrated wealth is. So if you're at the 90th percentile, you've done quite well.
90th percentile income-wise and wealth-wise in the United States.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. If you're at the 90th percentile, it means you're better off than 89% of the population. You're doing very nicely. Okay. If you get up to the 99 percentile, the 99.99 percentile, the 99.999 percentile, you're getting into the range of people who control enormous quantities of wealth and correspondingly have enormous amounts of political power.
Right.
These are the people who can give $10 million to a hidden political action campaign, and it would be like, you know, like change falling out of my pocket or yours.
Right.
they control investments. In France in 1980, there was a presidential election, and a left-wing socialist named François Mitterrand was elected. And Mitterrand said, you know, we're really going to move in the direction of socialism, not just social democracy. We're going to really move in the direction of radical democracy and socialize a good chunk of the economy. And guess what happened? The French ruling class said, oh, no, you're not. Because if you do, we're taking our corporations and we're taking our francs and we're taking our dollars and whatnot, and we're leaving France, and you'll have no economy. And so Mitterrand Mitterrand did not have enough organized economic and industrial and social force behind him to pull it off. But he was the last person who's really talked about a dramatic rupture with the pre-existing capitalists.
That sounded rather blackmail-like.
Well, it is, and that's what I think we've heard a lot of and have kind of gotten used to. So probably the first and biggest thing, because it relates to everything else, is the question of concentration of wealth and power. Who controls the economy? And as we were just saying, since particularly the mid-1970s, actually the second couple of years of the Carter administration, pre-Reagan even, this country began moving in a very reactionary direction in terms of the concentration of wealth and power and in terms of attacks on trade unions. The three biggies are the concentration of wealth and power through changes in tax policy, through attacks on brutal attacks on unions, and through the shredding of what is called the social safety net, all of which have resulted in a concentration of wealth that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world except possibly in Russia.
Oh, God. And so I want you to make that statement one more time. So because I've watched this growing up, of course, and what caught my ear was the unions, the presence and power of the unions in this country, and the taxation turnaround relative to corporate America. Mm-hmm. Versus we the people. And in this, I've watched this, of course, over the last several years. So say that again. In the 1970s, the triad, the three things began to change relative to empowering these powerful entities of our system. Say that again, please.
Well, there were attacks on trade unions. Trade unions... I'm going to get even more general here in a second, but there's attack on the trade unions such that the number of private sector unionized workers today is only 5 or 6%. Back in the early 50s, it was in the 30%. It's dropped about 80% in the private sector. The only way that we have any labor movement today at all, really, is because of public employees at the federal, state, and local level. I almost caught myself, I needed to backtrack. In the 70s, also, something very, very important happened. There's a guy named Lewis Powell, who later became a Supreme Court justice, came up with the guy was terrified. He was terrified because of what was happening in the 60s and early 70s with anti-war movements, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the rising environmental movement. And he said, capitalism, corporate power is in danger. And so he sent out a memo to all of the bigwigs in the corporate world, and they began mobilizing. And they mobilized with resources that none of the others of us could even consider matching. They began developing infrastructure, educational institutions, things like law schools, going to universities and endowing a chair so that at the University of X, you would have a chair in international economics. They would control the chair. They would control the taught in the chair. Mm-hmm. And they begin developing this entire ideological and political infrastructure all across the country. That was the reversal. That was the real end of the kind of truce between labor and capital that came about after the Second World War, when there was, we had McCarthy, we had racism and all that stuff. But we also had a sense that after the Second World War, people were kind of in it together, and that the guys, mostly guys, who had fought had a right to a middle-class income and so forth and so on. All that went, by the way, in the 70s and in the period since. And the result of that has been the fact that wages have been flat despite a doubling of productivity. Wages have been flat since 1980, and all the wealth has gone to the top, really, to the top percent and less than a percent. People in the top tenth of a percent have had their income increase about six times, 600% increase, and their wealth has increased correspondingly.
Mm. Wow, and... something that comes to my mind when you talk about that, the place that puts the people in relative to their well-being, it's not just income or wealth. I think about one's health and I'm going to I'm going to read some of this. I'm going to read some of what you've written. Is that all right with you, Tom?
It's copyrighted, so you want to be careful. Okay.
Well, it just makes me think about the human, you know, the bulk of us. The United States has the most expensive and one of the most, and now this is about healthcare, most inefficient healthcare systems in the world. In a democratic socialist America, we would be healthier as the emphasis shifted from a race for private profit, like it is currently, to a single-minded focus on our health as the goal. Not profit, but health as the goal. A publicly financed universal health care system would replace our present non-system. We don't have Tom says, a non-system. In other words, a chaos system that we have now. It's not an organized, equalized healthcare system. It isn't. anyway, so a publicly financed universal healthcare system would replace our present chaotic system. A reduced emphasis on competition and other manifestations of consumerism and the toxic individualism could reduce stress and other psychological disorders and their associated physical ailments. Public health and pollution control efforts like is occurring in democratic socialistic countries will no longer have their efforts stymied if they conflict with corporate profits. That's the roadblock here in the United States relative to public health sometimes and obviously pollution control. All, which with respect to health for all of us. So human health and environment integrity would take precedence in a socialistic or democratic socialistic government, country. And democratic as in elected, socialistic as in
egalitarian public control.
Egalitarian public control. What does that mean? Egalitarian public control.
Egalitarian mean. First of all, egalitarianism in a...
Get close to that mic, please.
Oh, I will. Be glad to.
You know,
We're not talking about what some people see as the final stage of communism, where everybody's exactly the same and so forth.
No.
Okay. But what we are talking about...
Well, wait a minute. Is Finland a communist country, Tom?
Actually, Finland... supposedly has one of the most one of the friendliest economic environments for entrepreneurialism.
Oh,
it does not have one of the friendliest environments for billionaires.
Oh,
okay,
good.
So anyway, they
are a socialistic.
It's a mixed economy.
It's a mixed economy, but they have socialist. they have relative to health care for everybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And relative to safety nets for the underprivileged.
Yes.
They treat people equally, is the divide between the rich and the poor more equalized there than in the United States? Probably
much so,
very much so. And are the corporations that function in that country stymied like crazy?
They're regulated.
And have they all left and gone to I don't know, Vietnam?
They have not.
Okay,
they have not. And perhaps one of the reasons for this, again, and I think I mentioned it in the little notes here, is that the Northern European countries, the Scandinavian countries, mixed economy countries with historically with strong labor movements and a sense of social solidarity, always show up in the polls as among the happiest countries.
Among the happiest, the people the happiest. Say what mixed economy is again.
Mixed economy is where there is room for private enterprise.
Yes.
But there are generally high taxes. There's a social safety net. There's commonly an encouragement of unionization.
How about education for their children?
All this may vary somewhat from
But generally.
Generally, they want their children to be educated.
And they pay for it.
And they pay for it.
It's paid for.
They paid
through
for
college.
It. Yeah. And, they expect to pay for it.
They expect for it. I want you to... You told me a few minutes ago, before the show started, about... a friend of yours.
Oh, my little story, yeah.
Yeah, listen to this. Yeah. This is a friend of his talking with somebody from one of the countries.
It almost sounds like a joke, but I have a friend.
One of the countries. I got a friend, yeah. I know somebody. Yeah, well, listen to this.
I have a friend. It's amazing as it may sound, but anyway, so my friend, his family migrated here from Sweden a couple of mm-hmm. generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so he... excuse me. So he decides that he wants to go to Sweden just mm-hmm. to see where his genetic roots. His genetic
mm-hmm.
roots are.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes over there and he tells me he ends up in a bar sitting next to a guy who was a
oh, that does sound like a joke.
Except it's not.
So this Swede walks into a bar.
This American is.
American Swede walks into a bar.
So my friend is sitting next to this Swedish industrialist. And the
Swedish industrialist.
Industrialist.
So a person who
owns a company of some
company
sort.
Of some sort.
So they're talking, and my friend says, "Hey, you must really be kind of pissed off because of the high taxes over here. You pay pretty mm-hmm. outrageous taxes."
Mm-hmm.
I
said,
"Yeah, I pay high taxes, but I get a lot for it." He said, "You know, I and my family receive top-notch health care, cradle to the grave."
That they don't have to go to the bankruptcy paying for.
Exactly.
They don't at all.
My children have the ability to go have a top-notch education through the university level.
Through the university level as part of their citizenship, and that is without owing $100,000 or like $300,000 if they go to medical school.
He said through the PhD level if they have the interest and the aptitude. He said, "I have a safe
and
healthy
environment." No wonder
environment.
They're happier.
Safe, mm-hmm. healthy environment. I have a contented.
Do they shoot each other over there?
Very seldom.
Are there shootings like often over there, like they are in this country?
We should send them more sidearms and assault rifles. I think that's one shorty. No, but and so he says, and I have a generally contented, highly productive workforce,
mm-hmm.
and I'm filthy rich.
He is making plenty of money.
What is the problem? And this is from a guy who was, according to my friend, a capitalist. You know,
right?
And I'm not. And his employees were unionized, so they uh-huh. had the ability to mm-hmm. deal with him on a relatively egalitarian basis.
Wow. So when that story and that how that works for that industrialist that. Person who owns that business in that in Sweden, where they have certainly a degree of socialism mm-hmm. of significance, democratically,
right?
And how it works, and the happiness, you know, this being a doctor show and health and all that happiness, you know, and lower stressedness.
Yeah.
We're in a capitalistic society where the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and right. it's a structured class-like thing that it is, and we're fed this from day one. We're a stressed country. And I was playing, I really meant it when I said, and there aren't shootings all the time.
It is true. That is
yeah,
definitely
and,
true.
And, you know, I mean, that speaks to the stresses and the helter-skelter and just the unhappy way of life in our country. That's just one little example.
But just to follow up on that, mm-hmm. we talked earlier about health care, and those kind of shootings often are attributable to stresses relating to poverty, relating to desperation, relating to different kind of psychological disorders. There's an excellent book.
Of course
book.
They are.
There's an excellent book, a couple of years old now, by Angus Black and Mary Deaton. It's called... Death by Despair, and it goes into that in great detail about how poverty and the collapse of economies, particularly in rural areas, have led to a massive increase in drug abuse and the other kinds of social chaos that's accompanying that. I did want to mention, we're talking here about democratic socialism. The countries that we have referred to here really are not socialist countries. They're mixed economy countries.
Not socialist.
So if there's anybody out there who's a purist who wants nothing but a straight, you want everything to be publicly owned and da-da-da-da, that's not going to happen in the near future.
That's not what we're talking about here. No, that's not democratic socialism. So everything's publicly owned. Nope, that's not.
But I am going to say since I can't see the future, one of the things that we're talking about here, about disempowering the ruling class, mm-hmm. ultimately eliminating the ruling class,
yeah.
opens up all kinds of alternatives that I can't even begin to foresee. In a generation or two, maybe we will have that kind of society if people decide that they want to do it.
Uh-huh.
My old friend, the late Michael Perlman, the economist, who some of you probably also knew, wrote a book called Capitalism's Handcuffs, I think. And he talks about how a capitalist economic system limits our ability to even envision choices. We can't even imagine
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
So,
right.
what I'm doing right now in my own political life is trying to contribute to the promotion of some of these values.
To consider and discuss and to think about.
Right.
As alternatives and how we can institute that throughout in this country. Well, and something that you wrote in this paper talks about sustainability of capitalism.
Right.
And you know, if somebody might say to us, talking to us, well, oh, no, we couldn't socialistic tendencies in our country couldn't be sustained or couldn't be, au contraire, that could be sustainable if the people are, well, better taken care of, more stably right. taken care of by each other, right. and that therefore happier, less stressed. That is the sustainable way,
right.
something like that. A. B, capitalism, where the rich get richer, never satisfied, always richer, and the poor, therefore, are poorer. Okay. That, my friend, is non-sustainable. Well, will implode.
Yep. And you, my point extending on that in my little essay or whatever it is.
Yeah.
was
which I'm going to publish.
I was talking about environmental issues. That
yeah.
capitalism,
there you go.
Steady state capitalism is a contradiction in terms. Capitalism grows or it dies.
Say that again.
Capitalism is not sustainable. A steady state capitalism where you have, where inputs and outputs
equal
are in balance.
Nope.
Doesn't happen. Capitalism has to grow. The problem is, and that all sounds fine, the problem is that we are in a finite biosphere. We're living
we
in
are.
A finite world, and at some point, like now, those things butt up against each other. Frederick Jameson, who I quote in here, he's a philosopher and literary critic, said that many people find it easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism.
Say that one more time.
Many people...
That statement caught my eye, and I understand why it
why it jumped out at me too.
Yeah, and I can understand why somebody said it. Go ahead, say that again.
Yeah, Frederick Jameson, where credit is due, said that many people find it easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I think he's right, because we have had our imagination thwarted. Imagine, you know, if you try to imagine stuff, well, that's just not realistic. That can't
yeah.
happen, because we don't have a market for that.
By the way, many of those countries that are have free market economies, by the way, that still have significant capitalistic functions in via their government and happier people, they mm-hmm. still have free market. Many of them still have free market. I'm sorry, go
yeah,
ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, I just had to throw that
anyway,
out.
I agree with Jameson. I think that a lot of people have been trained, propagandized, bought into the idea that there's no such thing as enough, that the only way to have fulfillment in your life is to have more, and after that, to have still more. And I think almost all of us believe that on some level, because
wow.
we have been immersed in it.
You've been immersed in that philosophy.
That crap, yeah. Marx used a spicier word for that I want,
yeah.
which I want.
Yeah.
But I made a little note in this essay also that about a... excuse me, about a thought experiment that I did, and I would encourage other people to maybe do it too. My thought experiment was this. Have I been happier in my life when I have had the most money? And I looked back on my life, and I've had a pretty happy life, so I have nothing really to bitch about. But the happiest times in my life were not when I had the most money. It's when I had the most friends and the closest relationship with my family and the ability to do things that were meaningful for me and when I enjoyed good health and, actually, frankly, when I was younger because I was more energetic and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it had virtually nothing to do with having a ton of money. I probably have more money now than I've ever had in my life, and I'm happy enough, but I'm certainly not happier. The studies...
So money isn't happiness?
Money,
anti-American. Well, anti-capitalism, okay. Mystic capitalisticness. And I totally agree with what you're saying.
Money can be a source of happiness.
Say that again.
Money can be a source of happiness, and that relates to the issue of egalitarianism. Studies after study after study shows that there's a certain point, usually around $50,000, where no more money really increases happiness. So, you know, imagine if I came in today and said, "Ken, I'm going to give you a loaf of bread," you would say, "Oh, okay." If I went to some guy in Sudan whose family is starving and gave him a loaf of bread, he would probably be beyond grateful. So
this is important what you're saying, Tom. And so I want you to continue making this point. And I'm not even asking you to repeat part of it.
There's a point of diminishing returns. And what we would like to do, we socialists would like to do, is to make certain that society and the economy is organized in such a way that everybody is brought up to that level.
Everybody is brought up to a certain level of contentment. Is that, like you said, yeah. You know, the $50,000, I don't know, does that mean a year income?
Yeah, roughly.
Kind of thing. You know, the point is that, you know, somebody listening to this might say, oh, no, poverty, people aren't happy when they're poor. You know, we have to have capitalism so that they can have first of all, they're not going to get rich in a capitalistic state. They're going to remain poor, most of them, majority. But nonetheless, the point you're making is in a socialistic tendency country or economy, government, the people are people are happier. We're not saying people don't need to be wealthier. Some people don't need to be wealthier to be happy. There's a certain level of happiness that means you don't have to worry about getting food and other things, having money for it. In other words, a mid-level, a level of, like you say, maybe around approximately maybe $50,000, but not a zillion million dollars.
No.
But in other words, enough money for a very comfortable life, a comfortable life for all of us.
Right.
Yes, it's important.
I'd like to toss one more thing out here, too, because I don't think we've touched on it yet, mm-hmm. and that is waste in a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm.
We have, as you know, probably better than I, that we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. If we shifted to a Medicare-for-all system, a universal healthcare system, we would save hundreds of billions of dollars.
We are
throwing away mm-hmm. hundreds of billions of dollars mm-hmm. for the privilege of having an inefficient healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say this, we do, in fact, have some of the best doctors, nurses, technicians, researchers. I'm not putting down the professionals employed in our healthcare system. But they're working in a dysfunctional system. They're obliged to work in a dysfunctional system.
Mm-hmm.
There's other stuff that we have in a capital. There was a book, I don't have it anymore. It came out in the 80s, I think it was called Beyond the Wasteland. Written by a number of progressive economists.
Beyond the Wasteland. Mm-hmm.
And they talked about the money that we waste on advertising. Advertising doesn't educate you. Advertising amuses you and gulls you into buying stuff that you don't particularly need and spending money. I mean, if you'd buy it anyway, they wouldn't have to advertise for it. You know. Anyway, there's a huge amount of money wasted in advertising. You know, there would still need to be some way of communicating with people. You can have some advertising, but not this much. Law enforcement. Well, you have a system that generates crime. We know how to reduce crime. You reduce inequality. You reduce desperation.
Reduce inequality will reduce crime.
It will reduce crime.
Yep.
Nobody doubts that.
Which is going back to that gun thing too, in a way.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, and that a lot of that's anxiety. People with status anxiety, or people simply are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But you could reduce crime, and accordingly, you could reduce the necessity for prisons, mm-hmm. for courthouses.
It would decrease.
For all these, I don't think it'll eliminate it, but you could certainly decrease it. There's all kinds of costs that are associated with capitalism. Supervisory duties. The supervisors in a lot of workplaces are not focusing so much on training people. They're focusing on making sure people don't slough off at work because people are bored and underpaid. So I think that I wanted to end up with saying, okay, how all of this kind of stuff, we need a more egalitarian, more democratic, happier society. How do we get there? Well, we're not going to get there overnight. In fact, we probably won't get there in my lifetime, but we can take steps.
Steps, exactly. And start one of the starting places, like you say, education on the list of things that we need to do. Mm-hmm. Education is one of them, such as some of our Congress people who are kind of social. That are socialistically oriented, such as Bernie Sanders, et cetera, and Ocasio-Cortez. Yeah. Socialistic is beneficial, is good, it's sustainable, it's a positive. We need to educate the goodness of that.
I want to make one comment on that because I didn't get into it, but then I want to follow up with a little conclusion here.
Oh, great.
The Democratic Socialists of America, when I joined in 1982, had about 5,000 members. In 2015, we had about 5,000 members. Today, we have 90,000 members, and seven of our members are in Congress.
So seven members in Congress are socialists.
Yeah. Well, we have several.
Part of that organization. Yeah.
There are undoubtedly other socialists, but my point is this is growth.
It's growing.
This is education.
Growing over. Over time of so, late.
Okay.
Gotcha.
So we listed a number of things that we should be doing. The question is, what should we do? The answer is everything. But we list here political electoral activities, cultural activities, social activities, unions, boycotts, community building, so forth and so on. And I'm going to read my last paragraph
sir.
Because it's a marvel of, of whatever. Anyway, once we reject capitalism, as the natural order of things, a whole new world of possibilities opens to us. I call that set of possibilities democratic socialism. The future is not foreclosed. Some people have said that the future will be just like the present, only with more stuff. Mm. That's the best they can imagine, but we can do better. And I suggest we remember John Lennon's words in Imagine,
his song, Imagine.
His wonderful song.
Right.
Because we can do better, but everybody needs to pitch in. Everybody needs to find something that they can do. All of us can do something. And together we can make it happen.
Wow. And wow. Together we can make that happen and make it happen. And imagine another key word, and opening our eyes and our minds to options such as socialistic elements of our government's function, et cetera, and for the people. And relearning things we've been taught since we were hearing words, the socialism is a negative thing. No, it isn't. Social means caring for other humans. That's not an evil thing. Capitalism, a non-sustainable thing like capitalism, and all that wreaks, the havoc that wreaks for the environment, for people, and that's the negative thing in my mind. Democratic socialism. Wow.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you for being on the show, Tom. If somebody wanted to, well, people can Google democratic socialism, mm-hmm. to read about it and kind of get a feel for the ideas, and again, open your mind and envision what how we could implement these kind of things in our own local areas and in federal government,
and
state
if,
government,
and if they'd like to talk with me, they can simply email me at DodgerTom, DodgerTom 99.
Say that one more time, your email.
Dodger Tom, D-O-D.
Dodger,
D-O-D.
G-E-R.
G-E-R. T-O-M.
T-O-M. So Dodger Tom. 99.
At Comcast.net.
At Comcast.net. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hear more about this kind of ideas or discuss with Tom, Reed, Chico's social activist. Dodger Tom, DodgerTom99 at Comcast.net. Is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Okay, hang on just a minute.
I meant every word of it.
you meant every word of it. Excellent. Ooh, I got to get something up. Oh, darn it. I let the screen go. Well, Tom, talk a little bit more right now while I'm falling
off. I thought I had everything.
Hey, Tom, Butte County Healthcare Coalition, how could somebody have, you know, which is an organization that Tom started 30-some-odd years ago to be supportive of single-payer health care in this country, equal and appropriate health care for everybody. If somebody wanted to be a member of Butte County Healthcare Coalition.
I can't think of her P.O. box, but they could call me, and I can give them my phone number right now.
And you could actually email Tom.
You can email me, or you can call me at 530-966-3414.
What's your phone number again, Tom?
530-966-3414, and I will answer.
And Dodger, D-O-D-G-E-R, Tom, 99, Dodger Tom at Comcast.net.
Right.
Thank you so much, Tom, for being on the show.
Thank you, Kim.
This ain't the last time you're going to be on the show, I hope. Hey, the Doctor's Inn is made possible by the generous contributions of you all, plus D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit DALampeConstruction.com. And Lampe is L-A-M-P-E. So the letter D, the letter A. So DALampeConstruction.com. And by Mountain Sports for over 45 years providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. till 5:30 p.m. and 10 to 4 on Sunday at 176 East 3rd Street in downtown Chico. And I'm going to read you a little disclaimer here. You know that the voices, the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. That's the way it is. And I thank Mark Baker, the intern here, for his help and support for me doing this show. And let's see. Stay tuned for Planetary Radio at 7 or so. And I'm going to play you a Rolling Stones song here, I think, called "The Dear Doctor." So you can listen to The Doctor's Inn in 1 month, so the third Thursday of each month at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the evening. The Doctor's Inn. This is Dr. Ken Logan. See you in a month, I hope. Or you can listen to me in a month if you want to. I'm going to try to play this song, "Dear Doctor" by the Rolling Stones. Let's see if I can get that happening.
Okay. Dear Doctor, take one. Right.
Oh, help me, please, Doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's beating. Can't you please take it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Oh, help me, please, Mama. I'm sickening. It's today, that's the day of the plunge. Oh, the gal I'm to marry is a bull. Been soaking up drink like a sponge. Don't you worry, get dressed, cry my mother as you fly me.
Listening to the sounds of Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society.